how much control do you make sure you keep in the development and production of the infomercial, and what advice would you give an inventor who's ready to go to a production company as far as staying in control, adding your two cents, or just letting them handle it because they're the quote-unquote professionals?
Most inventors, and not to sound condescending or insulting, if they don't know the business, then there's not a lot of control that they're going to have, and rightfully so. I mean, some inventor that says, hey, I got this idea, and they scribble down on a piece of paper, says, this is going to be my million-dollar idea, which is not a lot of money, because if a project makes $1 million and I got $2 million invested in it, you can do the math. If he or she brings it to a production company and says, hey, I want X percentage, production company says, no, you know, you got to work by our rules, and here's what we're going to offer you. And an inventor, believe it or not, at least in the fitness world, will get a 1% royalty. That's just what a concept, because the company has to develop every part of that project from that sketch on a napkin, so to say. But for me, obviously, I bring more to the table because I know how to develop a project. So, you know, I have it patent pending, at least. I have prototypes done that are production ready, you know, ready to go. I have the manufacturer secured. I have a production company secured. And to answer your question, how much control do I give to a production company? I like creative people, and I want people to think totally different than what I think. So I tell them that they have creative input, because if I say, hey, here's the way to do it, Michael, I'd love to have somebody say, well, John, guess what? We could do it better. And it's like, oh, wow, that was a great suggestion, and or these are great people to work with. So, you know, when you work with people like that, obviously you have to give them control, because their business is their business, like your business is your business, and you take pride in your business. So you have to give them the pride to express themselves creatively, and in so doing, you're keeping your fingers crossed that their creative expression is something that's going to pull the good, profitable numbers for you.
From your experience, how can you handle the payment for the infomercial services? Do they demand 50% up front, all up front? Will they ride along with you, or all of the above?
You know, I guess I could say all of the above and more than the above. You know, just like any business, or most businesses, I should say, there's a lot of ways to structure a deal. Again, I do a lot of coaching with inventors. I tell the inventors, go with the lowest risk, because a lot of these guys are mortgaging their homes and liquidating everything and putting their life savings into a project. That's not the right way to do it. Have people been successful in doing that in the past? Yes, and I'm one of them. I mean, I sold everything I owned. I had to, you know, in order for me to bank on my intellectual property that I truly believe in. That's just one in a million where it's going to succeed like that. So when you license your property to another company, it's the best thing for most inventors who don't know the inventing, marketing, distribution, manufacturing business, because now you hand off all of the responsibility to somebody else, financially and otherwise, and you just sit back and get a royalty.
What is licensing?
But basically, it's like, I, John Abdo, have an idea, and Michael Senoff is a marketing company. Michael, I want you to manufacture, distribute, and sell my product. So we would enter into an agreement where I'm the licensor and you are the licensee, and you would pay me a royalty from units sold. Not units manufactured, but units sold. It'd be nice if you can get deals, and this is what I work with my clients to get units manufactured, but that's only if you have a relationship with the manufacturer, which is a very sweet deal. But at the beginning, if you don't have those relationships, then you have to work on units sold. Now, as a licensee, you have expenses. So you're going to say, okay, I will pay you X percent, typically to an inventor, a new inventor, that's only providing an idea, is 1%. And you may say, wow, 1%, you know, it's not that much. Well, it's not, because they have to put a lot into it. But if they sell a lot of product, 1% could be very substantial. And I've seen people become millionaires with 1% and 2% royalties and stuff like that. But there are the considerations that you as a licensee will pay off of net, not gross, off of net. And a good attorney, which I suggest everyone get, and there's many in our alliance who are great attorneys, will define what net is. And that doesn't mean that you're spending just money on airtime and the cost of goods, paying the people in your operation, things like that. Those are all costs of doing business, but it doesn't include, you know, the gas in your car and the meals on the weekend with your family, you know, all that other stuff. So the net really needs to be defined, and it really needs to be managed from an accounting standpoint. That's why a new inventor into the business may not know this, may not have his or her own accountant and or legal counsel to structure a deal like that. That's why, again, number one, it's best to license it out. So if you were to want to risk the money, I would invest the money in securing yourself legally and from an accounting standpoint.
Can you get rich on licensing?
Absolutely. My first deal, I made millions with my first licensing deal, but we sold over $300 million worth of product. But the thing is, and this is another thing I coach inventors, I may have mentioned this to you before, I call it the Barbie doll analogy. It's like, you know, you invent the Barbie doll, which would have died off decades ago, literally, had it not been for the little dresses and the little shoes and the jewelry, and then all of a sudden the purses, and then all of a sudden the Corvette, and then here came Kent. It was all that aftermarket stuff that really made this project a mega success. Well, like with the Abdur, I invented a product and I licensed the product, but I also had books and nutritional products and videotapes and accessories that add on to the product that were all under my control on the back end, which was a really wonderful, sweet deal for me, and I made nearly as much money on the back end stuff than I did on the front end licensing.
Okay, so with all your added products that you had, you didn't have to enter into licensing deals with those. Those were products you controlled?
What I did, because I had my own video production company, I produced the instructional videos, and that company sold them to the marketing company at a wholesale cost, so the difference that I got between my cost and what I received as a wholesale price was gigantic in comparison to the 1-2% inventor's royalty that I would have normally received. Which, by the way, with the Abdur, I got a different percentage, which I can't disclose. I have a confidentiality agreement with them. It wasn't the 1-2% deal. It was a much better deal because I also acted as spokesperson as well as some other facets of the project. So I wasn't just an inventor who had an idea that licensed just an idea, as I mentioned earlier. I had much more. So the company that I licensed the project to, I was able to negotiate a much higher percentage because they were at a lower risk because of what I was bringing to the table.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Would you recommend an inventor use a licensing agent or to handle it himself with an experienced attorney?
You know, I would have to say the first one. I mean, work with an agent who's had experience. You know I'm promoting my alliance, but it's not my alliance. These are people in the industry who work independently on various projects, who literally spend tens of millions of dollars a week in media when you put them all together and generate billions of dollars a year. There are agents out there who represent inventors. I mean, that's all they do is look for inventors, and they represent inventors. And for you to say, well, hey, I'm an inventor. I don't know this business, so I'm going to hire a good attorney. Michael, I've had inventors contact me, and I love reading contracts, even if they're not my contracts. I just want to see how they're worded and structured and really where there's loopholes and things like that. And I remember on one particular occasion, and this happened more than once, but this inventor says, John, I got this great attorney. This guy's fantastic. I'm paying him a lot of money, but, man, you got to see this deal that he put together for me with this marketing company. This guy was in exercise, and he was just ready to put ink on the dotted line, and he says, John, would you read the contract? And I says, you know, first off, I have to throw in a disclaimer. I says, I don't want to interfere with your legal counsel or anything like that. He says, John, it'd be between you and me. You just read it over. And I told him, I said, I'm not even sure if I'm going to even comment on it because I don't want to step in on anything. I read it. Michael, between you, me, and my mother, there's no way I would have signed that contract. And I just told the guy, I just had no comment, which to me is really safe in saying there's no way I would sign that contract, because if his attorney caught wind that I shot down that deal, then who knows what kind of repercussion would have happened to me. But here's supposedly a high-powered attorney that drafted this contract, and knowing what I know and how I've gotten taken advantage of in the past and how other inventors have gotten taken advantage of in the past, I've seen so many loopholes in that contract that that was not a good contract. Now, the thing is, the parties that he was going to sign the deal with, would they have taken advantage of this guy? I don't know. But legally, today, contracts are approaching 30-plus pages, where 10 years ago, they were 5-6 pages long. So, I mean, all these different clauses and this and that is adding on only because more and more people have been ripped off and or received the shorter end of the stick, and they need protection. And the only way they're going to get that is through some legal written document. So that's why the contracts need to be constructed properly. To encapsulate what licensing really is, especially to new inventors out there, Michael, it's just a way for you to get your invention to be bought by or invested by another company, a reputable company, a company that knows how to develop, manufacture, distribute, and sell a product at the lowest risk possible for yourself. So you're basically licensing it to them, which means they pay you a fee for every product that they sell.
Can we talk a little bit about inbound telemarketing? Inbound telemarketing, your infomercial goes up, it's aired nationally, sometimes internationally, and there's a phone number to call. How important is this step of the process, your inbound telemarketing, and have you made any major blunders in this area with your ad doer?
Inbound telemarketing is not just one thing, it's everything. You spend all this money to produce an infomercial. You spend all this money to buy inventory because you have to have inventory in a warehouse because you can't advertise without something sitting there to be distributed. And you spend all this money on media. Then all of a sudden the phone rings. You got some guy over there who just had an argument with his wife, pick up the phone and say, hello. You know what I mean? That's not the way that they are, but I've caught telemarketers with a bad mood. And I train my telemarketers and I say, no matter what you do, no matter how the call on the other end sounds, because a lot of them are scared, they're apprehensive, they may sound abrasive or rude or angry or whatever, the operator must always keep a smile on their voice. That's so important. And I've listened to calls that within seconds, 30 seconds, 45 seconds, certainly within a minute, the caller who was, yeah, what's this thing all about? I'm not sure if I should buy this thing. Is this another gimmick? You know, I've been ripped off before and all this other stuff. And the agent who's listening and corresponding with this caller is cordial, patient, nice, agreeing to some degree with the caller, like, yeah, I know there's been situations, I too was ripped off and stuff like that. But when they keep the smile on their voice within a short period of time, that settles the potential customer's concern. They have a level of security, they build in a trust factor, and now all of a sudden they justify them taking out their credit card and spending their hard-earned money on something. So your call people are very, very important. I mean, without them, that is the liaison between the customer and the money being deposited into your bank account.
So you've got huge call center. You can outsource all this to professionals who handle it, who are standard in the industry, Mountain West and other inbound telemarketing companies. But what about when just starting out, maybe you're doing a pilot and you're testing your infomercial? How did you handle it? Did you go to the big guys first, or did you start with a smaller inbound telemarketing operation that you really had all the control over?
No, we went to the big guys first because, I mean, we had big plans, we had big aspirations, we had big projections. So you go with the big guys first because you want them to be there right from the get-go. I mean, they know that you're starting with a lower media spend, you know, tens of thousands per week as opposed to hundreds of thousands per week in media. So they need to be matured as well because they're going to make mistakes. They need to feel confident with the pitch. They need to feel confident with corresponding, the frequently asked questions, the concerns, the complaints, all that other stuff. So let them learn. Let them record the calls. Let them listen to the calls. And a good telemarketing company won't just say, okay, we're done with John Abdo's product. Now let's move to somebody else's product because they answer phones for a lot of people, not just you. They will huddle up and have actual meetings, even some mock meetings where they'll say, okay, here's a scenario. Caller calls in and says she wants the product, but she fears that her husband's going to say, get that thing out of my house. How would you handle a caller like that? So you go through these mock phone calls, and it's like, wow, that was pretty cool. And by golly, there are women who call up and say, boy, I'd love to have this, but I don't know how I'm going to justify it. Is this something my husband can use? Do you think he'll use it? The last 10 things I bought from TV, he told me, get those things out of the house and get credit back on my credit card. You know, it's a funny world out there, Michael, and you have to think of all scenarios. And because I have firsthand experience with every part of the project, including customer service, again, as we've been talking about throughout this discussion, most new inventors and even experienced inventors don't have experience and or knowledge in these areas, which is one of the reasons why 97% of all infomercials fail. Even the big companies who have this experience, it's like trying to shoot bullets at a moving target. I mean, you really have to have the perfect aim sometimes.
What advice would you give me when I'm looking for an inbound telemarketing? What's important for me to know before I hire one? You can relate it to cost or the scripting of objections, your involvement with them. Give me some tips on what I should look for when choosing an inbound telemarketing operation.
Well, when choosing an inbound telemarketing operation, like any facets of the business, all facets, as I mentioned before, are risky. First off, you want someone who's going to sit down with you. They take interest in you. They take interest in your product. They take interest in the program behind the product. And at the same time, they're going to spend time training their telemarketers. And that means, you know, hey, give us as much information as we can right now, and, you know, we're going to do some mock sessions. You know, we'll be ready when those phones start ringing. We're not going to just start testing our skills once the phone starts ringing, because we know when those phones are ringing, you guys are spending dollars. And we want that to be as maximum a revenue generator for you as possible. So we're going to be prepared as possible. They should use the product. You should send them products where they could use it so they have a familiarity to it. And you, the inventor or the marketing people, should spend time not only writing up scripts, which there's a lot of writing to be done because these telemarketers, most of them, especially at the beginning, all they do is read. And if you've called people over the phone, it's like you can't break their flow of discussion there because they got to read that script and or that screen before they click onto the next screen. So train them to have what we call in-the-can material, but at the same time be able to flow with the discussion and sound conversational to the point where the consumer is comfortable and impressed. And that's the key, or some of the keys, to a very successful inbound telemarketing campaign.
All right. How much should an inventor expect to pay their telemarketing operation, and how do they get paid? And how do I know if I'm being treated fairly as far as compensation? How do I not get ripped off?
Every telemarketing company is going to have their structure. There's obviously set up costs, and the costs that you want to incur as far as training them. I fly out, and I sit down with my telemarketers. They can't believe John Abdo, the guy that they actually seen on TV, is actually there to shake their hands, to put my arm around their shoulder and says, guess what? I don't consider you guys an outsource. I consider you guys a partner because you're getting a percentage of this. So there is a fee that you pay them, but there are some commission structures and things like that that, again, are negotiable. So to know if or if not you're getting ripped off is really not to point your finger at them. What you have to do is, number one, get the phones to ring, and then you can look at the conversion ratio. If the conversion ratios are allowing you to say, hey, this project is breaking even, or we're in the black, we're making a profit, then, hey, our call center is doing well for us. So that's when you know if everybody is working properly. And a real secret, which is not too big of a secret internally anymore, do some cold calls. Call up. I mean, the operator, even me, sometimes I don't even have to disguise my voice. I'll call up and say, hey, I seen this thing on TV. Can you describe it to me again? And you ask a bunch of probing questions.
Do you give feedback to your account manager?
Oh, I give feedback to them because I tell them whether I'm a minute into it or 20 minutes into it. I can keep them on the phone forever. I say, okay, I need for you to abort this call. I'm John Abdo, the inventor of the product. And, oh, yeah, John, yeah, we know you. Either I compliment them, say, boy, you did a great job. You know, I was just asking some questions that have come in to me recently, and I just wanted to see how you guys are handling them. Or if they're not doing a good job, you know, I got to be the stool pigeon. I got to go to upper management and say, hey, this person does not know what they're doing, and they were rude, they weren't treating me properly and stuff like that. And I go, hey, I wasn't acting as nasty as some of the other callers that I've listened to. And we record all our calls. That's made obvious right from the very beginning. They're only for internal training purposes only, so they become very, very instrumental in helping us understand what the caller needs, but at the same time, who the telemarketer is and what and how they're conveying information to them.
All right, well, your account manager act fast. If you call up and you've got a telemarketer who's just rude and killing sales for you, can you get him off the phone immediately?
Oh, yeah. They hung one guy out the window by his ankles and were threatening to cut the roof off a 20-story building.
What you're saying is they are responsive. You're the boss still, right?
No, of course they're responsive. And, you know, the thing is, they thrive on our business. They know we're spending lots of money on media. And, Michael, I mean, with the AdDuer, we were up to $2 million per week in media. Phones were ringing like crazy, so they need to hire more telemarketers. They need to have fallback call centers because they say, hey, John, all we can get is 100 people in here, and you guys are advertising so much. Now we have other call centers. The number will instantly forward to other parts of the country, and we have backup operators there because of the surge of calls coming in. But at the same time, they know that their business relies on you. And if you're doing any type of business, they know that you're talking to other people who are doing any types of business, and they really do jump through hoops for you. Every telemarketing company I've ever dealt with has sincerely given me and my company their time and their best efforts. It's just like any other business. The people who are sitting there answering phones, if you go to these calls, call centers are sitting there in a chair for hours on end, drinking diet drinks and eating chips in between. They don't take care of themselves, and they're sitting there. It's a stagnant type of operation. So I tell my telemarketers, I want you to get up. I want you to use the AdDuer. And when I go there, I'm not just teaching them how to sell my product. I'm teaching them the whole doer lifestyle, how to keep themselves in shape, because I'm a motivational speaker. And it's like, hey, If you want to become successful in life, you could do whatever it takes to make money, but your body is the vehicle that takes you through this journey, and I want you guys to be healthy. Everyone on my team's got to be healthy, at least has to make a concerted effort to exercise their muscles and to eat properly. And the success stories that I get from people who work for me, Michael, is just phenomenal.
In your telemarketing operation, were you able to ever use outbound telemarketing after the inbound portion? Maybe, let's say, you weren't able to close a caller. Would you ever implement an outbound strategy to try and give the caller a chance to buy again?
Yes, absolutely.
Did it work?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. It depends on the operator, but usually the outbound people are far more skilled, they're far more educated. And I can't say educated meaning that the other people were not smart. They're educated as far as the persuasion of a sale, and they're more educated because they know now why the customer didn't want to buy the product. So they have information that the inbound caller had, but because the customer rejected that offer, that information was conveyed to somebody else. So, again, they're more educated from that standpoint. So I just wanted to clarify that. And they get paid a higher commission. You put more money in front of somebody's face, they're far more incentivized.
And that's all within your same operation?
Well, yes. Within my alliance, I have outbound telemarketers who are very, very good at what they do.
Or is your inbound operation separate from your outbound?
Yes, they're very much separate.
So you could take those inbound names and 2 days later get them to your outbound department and work them that way?
24 hours later, they're there.
On that inbound call, you're able to capture name and mailing address from the very beginning?
We don't need mailing addresses anymore. We're very rarely sending anything physical mail anymore. Email address and phone number is what we shoot for. And if they don't give us email address, we got them on caller ID, so we do have them. And we do honor all the rules and regulations of the do not call list. So all that is monitored and regulated, and we follow the strictest of governmental standards and all the regulatory guidelines. So we want to protect people's privacy. But if they made the call and they were interested in the product and they didn't order, number one, we want to know why they didn't order, and number two, we have a payment option that we believe is going to entice them to at least give this a try. And again, I'll reiterate, and I keep reiterating with my telemarketers, they still have a 30-day money-back guarantee. So even if they decide to go on it now, they still have 30 days to try it and decide to stay committed to it.
How much real-time feedback as far as stats and numbers are you able to access with your telemarketing firm, and how important is that?
It's very important because at the beginning, a lot of calls that come in, maybe 10 minutes, 12 minutes, like, oh, how could those calls go that long? But as the operator becomes more skillful, that 10-minute or 12-minute call goes down to 8 minutes, 9 minutes, and sooner. Now, on our end, because the media has been building up week after week after week, month after month after month, the audience is impressed. So when they call up, they say, I want to order this product. Where at the beginning of a campaign, especially if it's a new campaign, can you tell me more about that product? Tell me more about that product is a longer presentation than, hey, I want to order this thing. I've seen it on TV, I'm impressed, here's my credit card. So you want to reduce the call time because there's other people waiting to get into these operators. You want to reduce the call time. And obviously, there's different options. You know, you could pay all up front and you'll get some bonus item or a free gift or something like that, or a payment plan. So they have to get to the options. Like, Mr. Sunoff, as a result of your order today, you will get this free gift if you pay everything all up front. Or you could decide to go with the payment plan, but you can't get this free gift if you go with the payment plan, but you do have the option of purchasing it separately down the road.
So what have you found works? Obviously, I've seen on infomercials they're doing smaller payments in installments. When did this change occur, and how effective is it? When you see people ordering the product, does that bonus help them pay for it all up front, or do you see most people taking the payment plan options?
Well, the people who can afford it will pay all up front, and the people who are really interested in the product will know that the bonus item that they're getting, like with the Abdur, you get a free tri-roller, which is a $55 attachment, and we sell lots of them at that price individually. They get that for free if they pay all up front. And what we do, and I tell the operator, make sure the customer knows that even if they pay up front and all their money has been transferred from them to us, they still have 30 days to exercise their money-back policy. So there's really a very low, low risk for the customer. We want to make it very fair to the customer. If the customer doesn't want the product, I don't want them to have it. I don't want them to complain about the product. Return it if you don't like it. The payment plan is for somebody who really has a slimmer budget, and DRTV products, which are under $200, a lot of products are under $150, most of them are under $100. These are exercise products where their whole body is on this machine, and that's the price point that they're willing to pay, but they want to stretch it out. So if they stretch it out, that's fine. But again, they don't get the bonus deal on there because it takes us longer to recuperate our money. It's very expensive for a company to send a product out. For instance, if it's a $200 product and the first payment is $50, we only get $50 of that $200, and there's other costs incurred in there. So our company has to float the money or sit on debt for a long period of time, and that's not the easiest thing to do, but the payment plan options came into effect years and years and years ago. And it was a way to say, hey, let's get it to the customer. You know, if they like it, they're not going to return it, and we'll keep our fingers crossed that they make all the payments.
All right, within the industry, can you give me any insight with these payment plans? How often do you find people who sign up for payment plans, their credit card will decline on the second or third payments, and how much of that goes into collections? And is this becoming a problem in the industry?
It's always been a problem in the industry. That's why a company has to be well-funded, and it gets right back to licensing. If you say, hey, I'm going to do this whole thing myself, all of a sudden you sell 1,000 products, but you only got first payment, not full payment, you're millions of dollars in floating debt. That obviously hurts a company. So when a company is strongly funded and supported, then they have the ability to endure that accounts receivable situation. And to answer your question, well, 100% first payment. Second payment may go down to 90%. Third payment goes down to 70%. And the fourth and fifth payment sometimes is zero. So sometimes you never even collect all the money in a collection situation like that. There is recall and there is some repercussion. It's not happy for the customer. The customer has violated their agreement with the vendor, and there are legal actions that can be taken.
There's got to be fraud within the industry. People up late at night and they see these payments and they're ordering products. Is there some kind of organization that monitors fraudulent buyers?
I think that's a good question, and it'd be good if there's an agency like that popped up, and I'm sure there's some agencies over there that are slapping people on the wrist. But to my knowledge, as of right now, and it's a question that I wasn't prepared to answer, but it's an interesting question because all of us in the infomercial industry and any type of direct marketing for that matter, or people who have to go on payment plans, or people who pay with credit cards and or checks especially, that there's not enough money in their bank account. Yeah, there are a percentage of people who get away with it, and obviously they're hurting the companies who are doing a legitimate business and trying to help people.
Let's get into a little bit about aftermarketing, and you've referenced this a couple of times in our interviews, John, with the Barbie doll. Most people who see an infomercial may believe that the infomercial product, because it's on TV, is a money maker. Could you tell the listeners, do most companies who sell a product on the infomercial make a profit on the first sale of that product? In other words, where's the money made in this business?
But to answer your question, no. A lot of companies do not make money on the infomercial. They're still in the red. Some of them just break even if they're lucky. And, you know, I've been in situations where, wow, we're really profiting hand over fist on this, but it may not be consistent week after week after week. You may have a couple of really bad weeks, like, where the heck did that come from? It's like, oh my gosh, how much do we spend next week? And it perks back up again. But again, it's rolling the dice. But what really needs to be considered, especially again, talking about the licensing, when you license a product to a reputable company, they got a list of customers that they've had for years and years and years, sometimes millions of people on their mailing list. So if they don't sell a product from TV, they send out an email blast or put it on their website for all their satisfied customers. Hey, guess what? We have new folks. And so they already have a built-in sales mechanism that lowers their risk, assures sales. It's low cost or zero cost, obviously, if they do it through email and a website, aside from the cost of writing the page for the website. So that is a guaranteed sale. As an inventor, if you don't have all these other channels and you don't have names on your mailing list, and some people say, oh, yeah, I got 20 names on my mailing list, that's obviously not enough. I know companies that have millions of names on their mailing list. So when you do business with them, you say, hey, they got TV, they got the mailing list, they got retail distribution, both domestic and international. They have a website. They got outbound telemarketing. They got catalog sales. They got a lot of stuff going for them. The chances of that project becoming successful when you license it to a company of that magnitude are far more likely than, again, trying to do it on your own.
I think I hear you saying is it's critically important to own and control your buyer's names, your names. Is this something that's negotiated in a licensing deal? Is there a struggle over who gets control over the names?
Of course, because my company, whatever advertising I do, I'm putting big dollars out there to get the phones to ring. And when the phones ring, obviously we're capturing customer information. That's vital for my company, not specifically in and of itself for that project, but for the future health of my company. Because when I come up with another project, I want the people who bought today and yesterday and yesteryear to be aware of what's new, because I have a trusted brand and people want to hear what's new. So, yes, that list is very valuable. Are there situations where you can negotiate to get access to that list? Yes, to own it completely. That's a tough one, unless obviously you're paying for the media or paying for other things. But again, all aspects of a business transaction are negotiable, and I would at least put that up for discussion.
Do you have total control over your names?
I have total control over the names of the people who are involved in the projects that I fully fund. If I license a project, which I still do and I will continue to do, because some projects I don't want to go full funding with them, I'll just license it to another company, then I may get access to those names in a capacity, but in all due right, and I understand they're the ones putting up all the money, they're the ones producing the infomercial, they're the ones buying all the airtime and spending millions of dollars, let them have the names. I mean, that's out of gratitude for them. It's like, hey, if this project makes it, we're all going to have some great things to talk about, but if it doesn't make it, at least there's something that you could ride on in the future to help you recover from some of your losses.
What standard return rate in the industry, and how do you compare?
That return rate has gone up, Michael, over the years. I mean, it continues to go up. You talked about customers and consumers taking advantage of companies. That's another way. It's almost like the lady that goes into the clothing boutique on a Friday night because she's going on a date either Friday or Saturday, and she buys all these clothes, and then Monday morning she returns everything. You know, the return rates have gone up. It's been very disappointing for everybody in the industry, which, again, is another reason why you want to license your product to a company who's well-funded, who's very much aware of the growing rates of return. I mean, at one time, 12% was considered high. Today, 16% is normal, and it could jump to 18 to 20%. That means out of every 100 products you sell, 16 to 20 units are coming back, and you got to refund all that money. And there's so much cost out of pocket because you had to ship the product, you had to pay the telemarketing, the warehouse, you got to refurbish the product because you know the box is all torn up and all the contents may have been not repackaged properly because they have to return it in the original packaging. It's not an easy business. And again, I've grown to the point where I fully operate projects from A to Z, and it's not easy, but it's one of those things where it's far more profitable if and when I fall within that 3% of the projects that do work. But as an inventor, consulting other inventors, what I advise to them, go as low risk as possible. If you believe in your idea, let somebody else put up the risk and the capital, and you just enjoy your inventor's royalty. But as time goes on, if you think that this is your only invention, your only idea, then bring as much to the table as you can, or wait a little bit, as long as you can, to develop as much as you can to where you can get a higher deal for yourself, so it's a little bit of a lower or a lot of bit of a lower risk for them, and you're bringing more to the table. But for me, I knew my first invention. It's like, hey, I know what I'm bringing to the table, but I know that I'll have other inventions, and I know as the months and the years progress, which has materialized, I'll become more knowledgeable, and I will be able to offer more to companies I license to and or operate as much of the operation as I choose to.
Do you rent or put on the rental market your mailing list?
Some of the companies I've licensed the product to may have, but I personally don't. There could be good money into it. It's a nice source of additional revenue, and then people are always calling me and asking me for it. I just haven't done that yet, Michael. I get a lot of junk email, and I get a lot of junk mail, you know, physical stuff that comes into my mailbox. It's like, I don't want this stuff. And I tell the mailman, can I get rid of it? He says, yeah, you fill out a form, and then it's discontinued for a while, but it's going to come right back 3 months or 6 months later. So I don't want to give to other people what I don't want myself, so I haven't done that.
How important is the actual packaging of your product when selling a product on TV?
The packaging of the product on TV doesn't need to be that glamorous. In fact, the less glamorous, the better, because you don't want some fancy colored box shipping through the mail or the postal system because people are going to see it. And if it's sitting out in front of your office door or your apartment or home door, someone's going to snatch that thing, you know? So it comes in what we call just a brown box, a plain brown box, and it'll have some markings to it. But for retail, the packaging is everything because people are walking through there and they have to be caught visually by this, not by the colors and if there's models on there, which my picture's on there. I keep myself in shape, so I'm showing off my six-pack abdominals, and there may be a nice-looking, shapely female fitness model along with the bullet points that will help you lose body fat and trim your muscles and comes with an eating plan, things like that. So all that is visually demonstrated on the packaging for retail. That's the exterior. The interior, again, is another everything type of thing, because from the factory to the warehouse to the customer to the retail shelf, there's a lot of shaking and bouncing and trembling that goes on. So the inner contents of the box need to be packaged properly. When the customer opens the box, they don't want to go, oh my gosh, I need a chainsaw to cut through all this stuff. So it's got to be packaged where the customer appreciates how much effort went into protecting the product, but at the same time making it easy for them to remove the product from the box and to get the product ready to be used.
All the return products, when they come back to the factory or the company, what happens to all that actual product, and how do you keep it from being distributed into the closeout industry and having them end up on eBay and auction houses where it decreases the value of your TV product?
Well, that's two questions that you asked me. Let me answer the first one. The first one, the products that come back to the warehouse, most likely they need new boxes, and we have boxes that we put them in, the exact boxes. Unless the box is not damaged, which most likely they are, because there may be tape on there, and you know when you pull tape off how it tears the cardboard and stuff like that. And we look at the product, and we assemble it. We have an inventory of spare parts and or pieces from older products that have come back and said, that piece is bad, throw it out, that piece is still good, you know, let's keep that. So we refurbish them. Now, if we sell a refurbished unit or resend a refurbished unit, the customer has to know it's refurbished. So we'll let them know, and usually they get a discount with that. So again, it lowers our profits. It costs us more to refurbish a unit, obviously, than to distribute a new unit. But we do have a backup plan for returned inventory. Now, your other question about the eBay stuff, that's something you can't prevent. These are secondhand units. You know, I get people who've written me quite a bit, hey, yeah, I own your product, but I lost the manual. Can you give me a new manual? Or I lost the DVD. And when you really figure it out, and I'm just giving an example here, but this happens a lot, here's somebody who bought a product from somebody who owned the product, from somebody else who owned the product, I mean, a second, third, fourth hand. They bought it at a garage sale or a yard sale, and all of a sudden they're trying to get something from you. And when they tell you what they paid for it, it's like, oh my gosh. But you don't know what kind of condition it's in. I've seen exercise products, mine included, on back balconies in the Midwest where there's snow on top of them and the rain and the elements and stuff that really degrades every single piece of raw material on that product. So when you buy something secondhand, of course it's not going to be as valuable. And most people, as you know, at yard sales or eBays or garage sales and thrift marks are just saying, hey, just give me anything for that. Just give me pennies on a dollar.
Does one who's considering selling a product through television have to worry about regulatory issues and ABC agencies, for instance, the FTC? And if so, what advice could you give them before they launch their product on TV?
To answer your question, absolutely. And I wouldn't call it worry so much. I mean, you have to worry if you produce a project and put it on TV, and then all of a sudden you find out, oh my gosh, we are not fitting up to the standards of the regulatory committees, including the FTC. The FTC is a great group of people, and you hear both sides. Some people hate them, other people enjoy them. I enjoy them because they keep my project up to current standards. They're protecting the customer, number one, which any type of business or any part of life, Michael, it's not about me, it's about we. It's what you're doing for the consumer that's going to make your business thrive. So if this project has been approved by the FTC, which the attorneys within the alliance that I've created are FTC privy, meaning that they meet with, they attend seminars and or consult with FTC attorneys, so they learn the current rules and regulations, what can't be said, what can be said, can be demonstrated, can't be demonstrated, things like that. Then when you put the project on the air, you got, again, up to $1 million invested in the infomercial. You got hundreds of thousands, if not more than that, invested in media time, your inventory. You got a lot of money invested. All of a sudden, you get a notice saying you have to take that show off the air, or the TV network says this show has been looked at by our legal department and it's not passing current regulatory standards. Like, why not? Why not? You've heard these infomercials saying that they're going to cure this or cure that by just popping this pill or by doing this motion or whatever. You know, even if that stuff is true, it's so hard to believe, so you have to be able to substantiate that. So do whatever it takes to legalize your project so it's something that once you put it on the air and you get it out there in distribution, you are comfortable in knowing that it's already been approved. And you get a letter from the attorney who's approved it, because even before we go into production, the attorney reads the script. And a lot of times when I do an infomercial, I ad-lib because I know my product so well, I don't need a teleprompter or a cue cards or anything like that, but at least I tell them what bullet points I'm going to hit. And once we edit the show, then we send a rough cut to the lawyer. listen to this show, watch this show, and then they'll come back with a bunch of notes. What did John mean about this? Was this testimonial a paid testimonial or whatever? And you go through the checklist, and it may take weeks, it may take months, but once you get it right, then all of a sudden you have the confidence to put your investment out there.
How can one protect themselves from product liability suits? And if you are the licensor, like you're licensing your product to a marketing company, can you be personally liable in product liability suits?
Well, if your first question is obviously to have an insurance policy, and you have to set up a corporation for yourself to where you're an employee of the corporation, you're exempt, but the corporation is liable and you get the insurance policy. And again, within our alliance, we have people who specialize in TV, infomercial, retail products from a liability standpoint. And as you can imagine, there's litigious things happening all the time, so you obviously need to be protected. When you license your property to a company, they have their own insurance policy, and they list you and or the project as additionally insured, and you're indemnified for all litigious actions, so they will protect you.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. For more interviews like this, go to HardToFindSeminars.com. Talk about what do you have planned here in the future, especially in relationship to people who want to become inventors or current inventors.
Michael, it wasn't too long ago where something like this, you asking me questions, internally knowledgeable questions, that I says, there's no way I want to share this with anybody because this is valuable information that I've gained over the years that has allowed me to make me, my company, and the people that I consult lots and lots of money. Some people have become super rich as a result of it. But I'm at the point right now where my expertise, my alliance, which I'll explain in a second, and the information that I have about this, and it's not just me, again, it's the alliance, that is a product. And I've been developing what you would call an infomercial on infomercials. This audio seminar that you and I have had the opportunity to exchange with one another is questions about infomercials and or the business, and I want to share that. So that to me has been very, very important. Inventors and marketing people and project managers and producers and manufacturers have been tugging me at the sleeves for years, asking me for help, for opinions, to get involved, for me to license the product for them, et cetera, et cetera. So now I'm in a position, you know, I one day step back and say, you know, John Abdo is not and never has been a solo act. I got all these people from manufacturers to engineers to prototype developers to video production people to infomercial buying people and all this stuff that are part of the projects I'm involved in. So what I did, Michael, I went to all these people and I says, hey, how about if I promote your services and you give me access to the articles you've written, to the videos, I'll do audio seminars like you've done with me that I'll post on my website, and I'll promote you and your companies because there's people out there who need your services and are interested in that information. So I formed an organization called NICA, the National Inventors Coaching Alliance, and this alliance is headed by me as the founder and the CEO. But it's anybody and everybody who, if you go to stores right now, you're going to see their products on the shelves. If you turn on TV right now, you're going to see their products being sold on TV. These are the real people who are doing real business, producing real results. They are not consultants, per se. In fact, you'll never be able to get to these people if you just said, hey, can you give me a couple hours of your time or an hour of your time? I'll pay you money. I know one guy who turns down $20,000 one-hour speaking engagements because he just doesn't want to talk to anybody about his business. He just wants to keep it all to himself. And for him, it's the prudent thing to do because he's got a lot of secrets up his sleeve and everyone wants to work with this guy. But I have access to him and I could put him on the website. So what NICA is, NICAPro.org is the website. I'll be charging yearly memberships for people who come in, and anybody who listens to this, they could email me at NICAPro.org and tell me that they listened to the Michael Senoff interviews with John Abdo, and they're going to get a major discount for the yearly membership that gain you access to all the questions that you've asked me, Michael, but not only from my perspective, from other people's perspective. We'll have patent attorneys. We do have video production people, infomercial marketers, manufacturers. It goes on and on and on, and it's a live site. It's not a stagnant site where when you go there today and if you go back and visit it 2 weeks from now, it's going to be the same stuff. It's always being updated. And in addition to that, if you say, hey, I want to hire somebody or I want to work with this company, you submit your name to the list. We forward your name to that company who will ascertain whether or not they feel that your proposal is something that they can work with. with, or they'll just contact you to hear your proposal directly. And we're going to do one-on-one consulting, like I have been doing, as well as live seminars. So it's going to be a very diverse alliance that's going to help all self-help people, not just inventors. We even have professionals within the industry who are part of the organization because they want to learn from the competitors and from the other people that they have had short opportunities to work with and or haven't had the opportunities to work with but want to in the future.
Well, I think that's great because I think inventors are, you know, they're dreamers and they can be very vulnerable and they can be taken advantage of. And I think an organization like yours of trusted advisors who have all been screened by you will be a great benefit to the inventors out there who have less experience.
Well, you know, without inventors, you wouldn't be sitting on the chair that you're sitting on. I wouldn't be talking on the phone I'm talking on. I wouldn't be able to do my morning business. I wouldn't be able to do anything without inventors. Everything that you could see right now and for the rest of your day is a thought turned into a thing. We need inventors. We need the ideas. The thing is, the idea people aren't the marketing people most of the time. So I am here to co-join the idea with the idea maker, the star maker, so to say, and that's what the alliance is all about. I have always seen and shared a commonality with all inventors. We don't know who to trust. We don't know where to go. We've been ripped off before. We don't know if we're going to get paid on all our units. We don't know if we're making the right decision. It's fear, 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 distrust, distrust, distrust. So if you want to be the deer in the headlights, then just continue being on your own, and you're not going to go anywhere. If you join an alliance, you will have the comfort, the security, and the confidence to move forward and to expand yourself. And again, as I mentioned before, start easy. Get somebody interested in becoming the licensee of your invention, but at the same time, concurrent with that, learn the business so now your next invention or the time when you say, hey, guess what, guys? This thing's going good. I got something else I want to add to this project. Now all of a sudden you can add more and more and more, and it will snowball. So I'm here to protect inventors. I'm here to tell inventors I love them. They're my brothers and sisters, and I'm encouraging them because I thrive as well as everyone thrives on innovation. Without inventors, the world would not be as fast, as safe, as productive, as happy as it could be, as it should be. Inventors is what makes the world tick.
Well stated. That's perfect. That's exactly right. I agree with you. John, it's been a journey. You know, it's been a pleasure, and I'm really glad that you invested the time with me to do this because I know how valuable your time is, and I know you probably turned down a lot of opportunities just to rap, especially about all your secrets. I think by you sharing these secrets and sharing some of the lessons that you've learned, I'm absolutely confident it'll come back to you tenfold, even though you've given so much away for free, and I really want to thank you on behalf of myself and all the listeners at hardtofindseminars.com and whoever has the fortunate opportunity of listening to your story.
Michael, it's been my pleasure. I consider this a supreme opportunity, especially now admitting that it's time for me to let the cat out of the bag. People have been pulling me at the sleeves, and like I said a while ago, it's like, I can't tell anybody this stuff. This is internal secrets. But now I'm able to tell that to you because this is going to be a revenue generator for me because I have organized an alliance that's going to help inventors help themselves and hopefully make this world a better place to live in.
That's the end of our interview with John Abdo. I hope you found this helpful, and I know we've covered a lot of stuff. This is definitely the type of mini-seminar you want to listen to three or four times. There's so much good information here, there's no way you could have absorbed it in just one listening. Print out the transcripts there. Make sure you check out John at johnabdo.com and get going. I hope this interview has given you the encouragement to go for your dreams and you become that next million-dollar inventor. Thanks for listening, and be sure to check out my other interviews at hardtofindseminars.com.